All right, thanks. But I think I will be talking, and I'll try to make what I'm saying. I study generic cortex and study aspects of trial-to-trial variability that has surfaced in several talks this morning. And I'm also going to talk about assembly formation, which I think has a special place for people who work in the olfactory cortex in particular. So I'll try to make this relevant where I can, specifically to piriform. But in general, I'm talking about generic cortex here. Okay. I think a lot of us think about neural computation. I do. And I think about it in a broad sense. I'm really a dynamicist, so I think about the dynamics of circuits. And I want my circuits to perform computations, and there's a whole list of computations. But in all of these computations, you know, if we want to measure the performance of the circuit doing this, we need to really think of the system having some component of variability. Right. Any basic metric of coding has variability, at least as half of the component. A signal-to-noise ratio has noise on the bottom and is just as important as the signal on the top. So if we want to really talk about coding properly, we have to think about variability. We should think about it here. So variability, I'm certainly not the first to think of this. Lots of people have studied variability. It's all over the nervous system, and really at all scales. So at the level of the whole brain, trial-to-trial fluctuations in the bold signal, all the way down to trial-to-trial fluctuations in synaptic release here, and everywhere in between here. And we saw some nice examples this morning about trial-to-trial variability at sort of the mesoscopic level in terms of populations here. And this is calcium imaging in actual barrel cortex, where you're looking at responses of neurons on a trial-to-trial basis from a deflection of a whisker, and neurons respond on one trial, not on another, and this is very reminiscent to what we've seen in piriform cortex as well. Okay, variability isn't just present, it's also malleable. This is what gets me interested about variability. It's not just a constant in the system, but it changes here. And there's lots of examples of this. I'll sort of point to two of my favorites. Work from the Shinoy lab by Mark Churchland and colleagues has now shown, so here what you're looking at is some kind of abstract representation of the firing rate of a neuron that's involved in a reaching task. Here's his motor cortex. And each gray line is the trajectory of that firing rate. And we see when the animal is sort of in its pre-plan or it's in the spontaneous state before the target has appeared, there's lots of trial-to-trial variability here. And some of that variability is quenched or suppressed during the actual movement here. So variability is large before the task. And then when the animal's engaged, there's some active process that quenches variability. And I'll talk more about that later. And work from Marlene Cohen, when she was with John Monsell, has shown that top-down processes that mediate attention can also decrease the variability shared amongst cells here. So this putative noise correlation in the unattended case here is higher than the attended case, even though the firing rates have gone up. So there are mechanisms. Variability is present. Variability is able to be shaped by the nervous system here. So I want to talk about emerging circuit mechanisms of computation. I'm going to use computation very loosely today. I'm really going to be talking about assemblies as sort of the substrate or the backbone on which I think computation is performed and variability here. So I'll talk a little bit about my models of cortical variability, balanced excitation and inhibition, another theme that's been presented this morning, talking about assembly structure and then signatures of that assembly structure in the system here. Okay, so trial-to-trial variability in cortical systems has, at least in terms of modeling, has sort of a long history. It's almost two decades now that people have really been thinking about this from a recurrent excitatory-inhibitory framework here. So here's my model of cortex. I have a bunch of excitatory cells, a bunch of inhibitory cells, and I'm going to yank out a representative cell from this population and ask what it's receiving from this the cortex here. And of course, we would expect it to receive excitation, would receive inhibition, and the memory potential of that cell will undergo some kind of random walk subject to that pulsing here. And if I take a large population limit and I sort of say, what's the mean and the variance of that current into that representative cell, I can decompose it like this. And there's a lot of symbols here, and I'll parse this through here. So this J is the synaptic strength coming from an excitatory cell into this representative guy. K times N is the number of inputs it receives. N is the system size. N is the number of neurons in my network. And nu here is the firing rate of that population. So this first product here is basically the average excitation going into a cell. the size of a kick, the number of kicks it receives, the rate at which it receives them. Right? This is the same thing for inhibition. It's got a minus sign because there's inhibition. That's some external drive coming from an outside source. Okay? If we think our neurons are Poisson, then the variance of the input coming to the system is going to look like this. The only difference here is now J is squared, because now variance is a squared quantity, so I'm going to have to keep my units, I'm going to have J squared, and there's no such thing as negative variance, so inhibition ends up adding to variance as well. Okay? So if we want to study variability and have a network that studies variability, we need to be careful about how we scale connection strength with system size. So what's the relationship between J and N here? And if we take this relationship where J is some order one little j divided by square root N, then what that's going to give us is it's going to give us that the variance in the large system size limit is order one. There. So we haven't. If we scaled this in a more standard way, where perhaps capital J was one over n, not one over square root n, then variance would vanish in the large system size limit, and we've removed the thing we want to study. We're not studying variability anymore if we do that. But if we scale it in this way, then and this is basically meaning that our synaptic kicks are very large, much larger than the one over n scaling. One over square root n goes to zero much much slower than one over n. Then we're going to have variance surviving in the thermodynamic limit. And this scaling was introduced by Carl van Rijswijk and Heim Sompolinski, sort of motivated from observations from Mike Shellam and Bill Newsom back in the 90s here. Okay, but the problem with this scaling is what happens to the mean, right? The mean here has this square root n coming out in front. So now as I grow my network, right, it's possible that I'm going to get exorbitantly large depolarization or large hyperpolarization, and that's not a reasonable way to think of cortex acting as well. So if on the other hand we take everything inside this bracket and say that even though this term is large, this term is large, and this term is large, the sum of all these guys goes as 1 over square root n, meaning it's small. Now we can have order one variance and order one mean. And this is effectively the notion of a balanced network here. Because if I take the system as n goes large, then everything inside this bracket has to satisfy this equation, where I have large excitation, large recurrent excitation, and large inhibition, and a large external excitation, all coming to a friendly balance so that they basically cancel out in the large n limit. So this slide is to show you that in order to have variability be an emergent property of this network, one solution for that is to have balanced excitation and inhibition so that large fluctuations can survive. Okay, so when we do that and we let system size grow, we can get fluctuations in our representative cell that look sort of like a Brownian walk and don't disappear as system size grows. Okay. If we take, so why are balanced networks popular? I take some kind of network, I wire it up with an Erdős-Rényi statistic, so random connectivity with my system, and simulate up my network, I get sort of a salt and pepper-like dynamics in that network. And I should stress here that this is really, there's no other sources of variability to the system. This is completely internally generated fluctuations. So if you're like an aficionado, this is effectively high-dimensional chaos, not randomness here. But from bird's eye view, this is random, effectively here. So why do people like balanced networks? What kinds of things do they explain that make them popular here? Couple. So one is balanced networks give you for free this large distribution of spontaneous firing rates in networks here. So this is from the network. We have this log normal distribution. Some neurons fire at relatively high rates spontaneously. Most neurons do not. This is consistent with lots of data from cortex. This is from Tony Zader's lab, non-anesthetized auditory cortex here. You get this log normal distribution of firing rates in the spontaneous state here. The other thing that balanced networks capture that I'm interested in is the trial-to-trial variability that people report. And this is work from Tony Mobson's lab, and they've reproduced this in several places, and now it's even a little more contentious. Might be more variability. Anyway, this particular plot shows that as the mean response changes, depending on the stimulus drive to the animal and this to the cell, the variance scales in a way that they match one another. This is effectively a Poisson process, or at least in terms of first and second order statistics, of Poisson process, the ratio of these guys would be the Fano factor, and it's roughly one here, and in these balanced networks, the Fano factors are reasonably high, much, much closer to one than they are zero here. So balanced networks gives you heterogeneity, and it gives you variability. It also, so Jaime de la Rocha and Alfonso Renart, when they were working in Ken Harris's lab, decided to look at densely coupled balanced networks. So Haim and Carl van Riesvik really looked at sparsely coupled balanced networks where asynchrony was emerging by construction. Nobody was really connected to everybody, to anybody. This was like an ideal gas model of the brain. When you have dense coupling, in principle, you could have mechanisms to produce synchronous activity in the system, yet balanced networks still show asynchronous activity, and this is what they found in their networks, and we can get into the reasons for this, and it's really interesting dynamics. The point I'm showing this is consistent with some recordings in cortex. This is primate V1, recordings from Andreas Tolius's lab. These papers appear together in Science as a pair to sort of start a discussion on whether noise correlations are present in the nervous system. There was a lot of arguments and fights, perhaps because the stakes are low for this particular discussion here. All right, this is nice. This is also seems to be the case in this sort of one study looking at activity in piriform cortex. Piriform cortex has also famously got zero noise correlations on average here. So piriform cortex seems to be a candidate, at least for sort of an asynchronous cortex. Okay. All right, so balanced networks are nice. They explain a lot of things, but they don't do anything interesting in terms of computation, right? There's, so if I go back a couple slides here, I mean, where did it go here, this equation? Not this guy, the one where I take n to infinity, this. There's two of these equations, one for each population, the E cells and the I cells. This is a linear equation, so that means I have two linear equations. There's a unique solution, it's got one solution. It's kind of boring, right? It's a boring system, right? That's high school algebra, really, here. It's amazing, got a science paper in that sense. But it's a beautiful idea in terms of the variance, right? But at the level of solving that equation, that's just two linear equations with a unique solution. So what kind of computation can you do with that structure? We need to break that structure, and putting an assembly structure into balanced networks is an open problem, and that's what I looked at here. All right. Forward. So Hebbian assemblies is an idea that's very old, dates back to Donald Hebb, and it's the idea is we think that there's groups of cells that are coordinated in their computational power here, and then as a result also perhaps wired together with stronger connections here. So this is yet another figure from the Stettler and Axel paper, different one, I believe, looking at how there are indeed ensembles of neurons in piriform cortex that are activated with different orders, and these ensembles have some overlap, but they have a lot of distinct components to them as well here. So I use the word ensemble here because we really don't know if this is an assembly. We really don't know if there's actual higher degree of wiring between cells that are responding to the same order. So this is this neurons that fire together. We know that that's the case in piriform cortex. We do not know if they wire together. I do not believe we know if they wire together here, okay? We do know they wire together in V1. So work from Mirka Slogel's lab has sort of done heroic experiments where in the morning they look at responses to calcium responses in vivo to different oriented gratings to present to the animal. They get sort of the signal correlations or the tuning curves of the neurons to be able to measure signal correlation here. And then in the afternoon in the same slice, they look in and they look at the actual architecture between the neurons, and they see that as neurons become more correlated in their signal, the connection probability increases. So indeed, neurons that tend to fire together do indeed wire together. Right? So this is a sort of a really nice example that Hebbian architecture may be present here. Okay. So I wanted to take this idea of Hebbian architecture and embed it in these networks. So how am I going to train up assemblies in my system? Well, I'm going to use spike timing dependent plasticity as a candidate mechanism here. So I think most of us know that if there's a relation, so spike timing dependent plasticity has that if the postsynaptic cell fires before the presynaptic cell, the weight is reduced. It's the other thing happens if the weight is increased. And you get this sort of classic B and poo curve here, where if neurons tend to, there's this really rewarding causality in the synaptic pathway here. This is well known. What's not as well known is that this figure really depends on the protocol at which you investigate the synapse at. If you investigate the synapse with the 20 hertz protocol, meaning you do this pre-post at 20 hertz, you get sort of the B and poo style figure. If you get that protocol to happen at 0.1 hertz, so that means you do pre-post, wait 10 seconds, pre-post, wait 10 seconds, you basically just get depression, right? And if you do it at very, very high frequencies, you basically get potentiation here. So this time-dependent plasticity curve is shaped by the firing rates of the cells. So we're going to use a rule here. We use some rule from Michael Gropner and Nicola Brunel, but also Claudio Clopath, where if we take a realistic model of a calcium-based model of synaptic plasticity here, and we let the neurons effectively fire independently of one another, then the two variables isn't so much timing as much as the postsynaptic rate and the presynaptic rate. If the post and presynaptic rates fire at very low values, you get effectively no change in the synaptic weight. Here, white means no change. Blue means you're going to get depression here. So if the presynaptic cell fires at high rates, but the postsynaptic cell fires at low rates, you effectively get depression. And it's only when both pre and postsynaptic cells fire simultaneously at high rates are you going to get potentiation. This is much more consistent with classic LTP and LTD than timing-based things, but we're using a model of spike timing dependent plasticity here. So if I take my balanced networks and embed this rule in there and try to train up assemblies, this is what happens here. I'll talk about my training protocol in a second. I'll just sort of show you this. So I'm stimulating up, trying to drive subsets of the network in a way to embed assemblies into the system. But eventually, if I wait long enough, the system goes unstable, and the firing rates of the network go really, really, really high, and you get dynamics of the system that doesn't look at all like real cortex here. So if you just take balanced networks and embed STDP, excitatory STDP in the system, you're flirting with instability here. This is not going to work. So in order to solve this problem, there's been a sort of a movement in certain areas in theoretical neuroscience to start thinking about spike timing dependent plasticity of inhibition. So inhibition is also has a timing component, but it's really different than excitation. So excitation, you certainly have this pre-post giving you potentiation, post-pre giving you depression. If you look at the plasticity of inhibition, so now this is the strength of an IPSP, it doesn't care about timing. It's pre-post, it potentiates, post-pre potentiates here. This is when they're sufficiently close to one another. If you move them far enough away, you basically get depression, but there's no causality rewarding here. This is actually data from Rob Fromke's lab. Tim Vogels, when he was working with Wolfram Gerstner, took this and embedded it in a model and basically showed that inhibitory synaptic plasticity, what it's doing is it's asking the target cell to fire at a specific rate here. So it's a method of homeostasis. If the target cell is firing above, if the receiving cell is firing above its target rate, inhibition potentiates to lower that cell's rate. If it's firing below the target, it depresses so that the cell is able to fire at the target rate here. So if we take our balanced network and now put in excitatory plasticity and inhibitory plasticity and train my network, this is what we see here. So here's this representation of a subset of the network. You're going to see this sort of cascading waterfall here. I stimulate a set of the network, I get firing. I stimulate another set of the network, I get firing. Stimulate another set of the network, I get firing, it should stop. What I'm plotting here is the synaptic strength between neurons that are receiving the same stimulus here. So I want these guys to be in the same assembly. Here, this is the synaptic strength for neurons that are within different assemblies. Here, I'm going to let my training protocol run through its course. So I'm training up all of my assemblies. And this guy starts ramping up, and you should start to see sort of a Mercedes-Benz style pattern here. I'm looking at a subset of three of my assemblies within my network. Trains it up, and we get sort of reliable formation of assembly structure in our system. if we let the system sit for 500 seconds in our sim time and look at what the spontaneous dynamics of our network is, it's very different than what we had initially. This is very different than a classic balanced network. I'm getting sort of a spurious excitation of assemblies and then de-excitation of them that happen in a way that's consistent with the training set here. So this is the spontaneous dynamics before I train, and this is the spontaneous dynamics after I train, and this is very, very stable activity in the system. Okay. So why is this doing this? So the reason it's doing this is, so here I'm going to pull out two of my assemblies. One of the assemblies has lots of neurons, so I'm trying to train an assembly that has large number of excitatory neurons. Some of the assemblies have small numbers of neurons. This is the inhibitory input. And what inhibition is doing is it's, again, doing this homeostatic rule where it's effectively normalizing the system in a way that's similar to what Kevin talked about, but it's distributed across assembly structure here. So what happens when the system's running is cells that have small numbers of assemblies that have small number of members here have weak excitatory feedback. So in principle, they don't have a way to raise their firing rate up to compete with cells, assemblies that have large numbers of cells. So what inhibition is doing is it's sort of playing a normalizer here, or I guess a homogenizer. It's basically reducing the amount of inhibition to cell assemblies with small numbers of cells, allowing them to fire at high rates when possible, and doing the opposite to groups of cells that have large numbers, group assemblies that have large numbers of cells. So it's acting as this homeostatic regulator in the system here. And this is what we have. We have rich dynamics in our spontaneous state that reflect our training paradigm when we have inhibitory synaptic plasticity, and we lack that when we remove it here. Okay. So, yeah.
So the what happens with the assemblies?
Oh, there, it's ongoing. That's a great question. Yeah. So a lot of people who study formation of assemblies say after the training set, synapses magically aren't plastic anymore. Right, and that's not true in our case. No, absolutely. During, and this is actually good lead into this. So what we're looking at here is we've trained our assemblies up. So these are the synaptic strength of all of our 20 assemblies here. And what I'm doing here in this, or what my grad student Ashok Lewin Kumar is doing, is we artificially drop the synaptic strength of all the neurons within one assembly. And then now the spontaneous activity, because it's somewhat reflective of our training set, effectively retrains the network to go back. So in this case, the spontaneous activity acts as a stability mechanism, and it's important that it's active during the spontaneous case here, or spontaneous state. It retrains the assembly back up. Of course, if I destroy the assembly too much, then it won't happen, but it is stable to weak perturbations here. Okay? So I guess in the last sort of 5 minutes, I'll talk about a signature of this. So this is nice, but is this really what's happening in cortex here? Okay, so what are the statistics of my network pre and post training? So pre-training, I'll call that uniform. Post-training, I've introduced this clustered architecture, this assembly architecture. The firing rates of my network are still quite broad and heterogeneous, consistent with what we see in cortex. The Fano factor has actually gone up to a much larger value here, and that makes sense because our network is now subject to two sources of variability. One, the variability that just dictates spike emission time, but also now this slow fluctuation that's causing assemblies to go up into an active state, down into a low activity state, high activity to low activity state, and that's happening on a very long time scale. This long time scale is present in both the autocorrelation of the spike trains as well as the cross correlation between spike trains that are from neurons that are members of the same assembly here. So we've uncovered this long time scale dynamic. The reason for this is effectively an assembly now, when we've trained up an assembly, that group of neurons is somewhat bistable and it has a low activity state, high activity state, and you get this transitioning here that happens dynamically in time here. Okay, so this is a reasonable way to describe spontaneous activity, but what happens when the stimuli are, what happens when stimulus is presented here? So Mark Churchland has looked at this problem as well. So here, when there's spontaneous activity in his motor cortex, so this is a neuron in M1 here, this is before a target appears, he gets variability that's quite high, higher than you would expect for a Poisson process. So this is the Fano factor of the neuron activity here. Poisson process process would be one, his Fano factor is much closer to 1.5. And the reason they think this is the case is not only is there trough-to-trough fluctuations in spike emissions, you get this trough-to-trough fluctuations in the firing rate of the Poisson process itself. People call this a doubly stochastic process, right? The spike emission time is random, and the rate at which the spikes are emitted is also random here, okay? When the animal reaches to the target, and this is the same target in every trial, the firing rate goes up, but this extra source of fluctuations due to rate variability is quenched, and the Fano factor starts high and then drops to low values here. So this is what happens in motor cortex here. Mark went and asked a lot of people for their data, a lot of primate people for their data, and saw that this was a general feature of cortex, that in V1, when a stimulus is presented, Fano factor drops. Same thing in MT, same thing in V4, in decision centers, in reward centers, all over cortex. You get this notion that stimulus or decision or motion or some kind of activity that the neuron is engaged in ends up quenching its variability. This also might happen in piriform cortex. I dug deep into the supplemental of this paper here that recently appeared from the Yoshida lab, and here they have that when the animal, before the animal puts its, this is a decision task or discrimination task, with an odor, the animal puts its nose into an odor port. So before it does that, and you look at the spiking activity of that neuron, it has a high Fano factor, and then when it starts doing its first sniff, that Fano factor drops quite precipitately here, and this is somewhat similar to this data here. But I'd love to see other people analyze their data in this way here. So does my model do this? It will. So what's stimulation of my model? Here, this is the unstimulated case. I've got this symmetry in the system where all clusters are equally likely to be in sort of the upstate or the low activity state here as well. When I stimulate the system, that's going to break the symmetry. And one of the clusters, the one that gets, or a set of clusters that get stimulus, they're going to be much more likely to be in sort of this high activity state. And the other clusters are going to be much more likely to be in the low activity state because of recurrent inhibition. The system can only support so much activity here. So this is exactly what happens in our network. If I stimulate the assemblies that are in black or in gray, shaded in gray here, and I stimulate them between this period and this period, they sort of reliably, or more reliably than you would expect from spontaneous, transition into their high activity state. All the other clusters transition into the low activity state. And if we look at the Fano factor in our network, it's high during spontaneous, drops during the evoked, and then goes back up. If we take a vanilla balanced network with no clustering, the Fano factor doesn't change. Okay, so in the last, I think, last couple minutes, I'll talk about some ideas on what's the benefits of this. So what do we see here? This is effectively storing a stimulus prior. I'm able to train assemblies up in my network that are consistent with a stimulus set that I use to train them. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to drive a neuron either with a stimulus that it was trained on, or I'm going to present a new stimulus that the network has never seen and ask, how does the firing rate of that neuron change? If the input was from my training set, and this particular neuron was part of the assembly associated with that stimulus, you have high firing rates. This neuron is reliably recruited to respond. If I give it a stimulus that has sort of this network has never seen before, you get sort of low stimulus rates. This drop in Fano factor is also present for stimuli that are consistent with the architecture I've trained in, and the Fano factor is much reduced if it's a stimulus that the system's never seen before. So the combination of these two things are going to give you, so this is a high response, high trial average response, so this is a good signal. The reduction in Fano factor is more impressive for the trained system, so the noise is going to be lower. So the ratio of signal to noise is going to go up, and indeed we see that looking at sort of an RLC analysis for signal detection based on this single cell, if you try to get this neuron to detect stimuli it's been trained on, it does much better than detecting stimuli it's never seen before here. So this architecture is able to support signal detection. Also support pattern completion. So here's a scenario where if I look at the baseline, this is, I'm taking my assembly, I'm only stimulating a portion of the assembly here. This is the firing rates when I stimulate nobody. This is the firing rates of the neurons receiving a stimulus this is the firing rates of neurons that are not receiving the stimulus, but nevertheless part of the assembly. They don't change from baseline. This is for the untrained stimulus. The stimulated guys, they go up. But if I give the network the stimulus it was trained on, the baseline is pretty much the same as here. The stimulated guys go way up, and they tug the non-stimulated guys up as well. So this is doing pattern completion. So even though these non-stimulated cells aren't receiving stimulus, their buddy neurons that are members of their assembly are, and pulling them up. So it's doing pattern completion here. So I guess in summary, I've talked about how excitatory SDP can support assembly formation when there's a homeostatic regulation present, and I modeled this through inhibitory synaptic plasticity. A signature of this assembly dynamics is a stimulus-induced quenching of variability. Okay. And then the last couple slides, I talked about how this might encode a prior that sort of supports enhanced signal detection and pattern completion in these systems. All of this was done by a very talented PhD student in my lab, Ashok Litwin Kumar. I'm starting to do olfaction now, but he is definitely doing olfaction. He went to do a postdoc with Larry Abbott and Richard Axel at Columbia. So he'll be doing olfaction now for a while. This is the members of my lab. This is my funding source, and thanks for your attention.
Quick question. So I don't recall from all the Fano factor calculations, the measurements as well as your from your simulations, whether if you just pick the inhibitory, the negative responding neurons,
yeah.
You see the same effect, or
you do get absolutely. That's a great question. It's not something you could. It's not only the neurons that have elevated responses that have lower Fano factors. Neurons that have no change in response because they don't care about that stimulus. They're not tuned to that stimulus, or actually have suppressed responses. They also show a drop in Fano factor. The whole network is more reliable, both in suppression and excitation. Great question.
I didn't understand what the architecture of your network does. What is it all to all connected, or how is it connected?
Sure, it's sparse. It's not all to all. It's random initially. It's a random Erdős-Rényi connection. So it means random connections with the network. The connections between all cell classes here, for simplicity, was 0.2. Here. And that's not so important. So I can make the excitatory connections be much, much smaller, increase the size of that excitatory pool, make the inhibitory connections be more probable to match cortex as well, but it's certainly not all to all.
And how would your conclusions, to what extent do your conclusions depend on having a network connected like that rather than one that's very orderly like V1?
In terms of like columnar structure?
Yeah. Not columnar, just where the circuits are all determined, many cell types, and there's an inherent network set up by evolution.
So we haven't looked. That's a good question in terms of the theoretical community has to start looking at diversifying inhibitory classes. We haven't really started to look at that as a group. So I've started to in my lab a little bit. We haven't published work on that. So balanced excitation and inhibition is going to be in principle easier to accomplish when you have more subclasses of inhibition. There's more people to perform this balancing act, or there's more different ways to do that. So I don't think balance is going to be destroyed if you add in more nuanced architecture in your inhibition. The great thing about that is balance is also sort of a harsh mistress. You always have to have the system balanced. So if you start breaking up inhibition into different subclasses, that means certain classes of inhibition, maybe the PV cells, are the ones that balance, leaving other sources of inhibition to perform actual computations, not just regulation, not just staving off epilepsy, but actually performing competition between different subgroups and so forth. So I think this is an interesting area we should go into. I don't think the basic properties of the network that I've shown are going to be destroyed when we put in more specific subclass structure.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking about cell types, but I was thinking about the connections between the cells. The inherent connections. I mean, you're not assuming that all the connections are generated by Hebb, right? That you're saying
there's that's right. So there's an initial connection structure that's completely random. Okay. Right, so that there's certain cells that have synapses between them.
Yeah.
So if you and I are cells in the network, there's a 0.2 probability that we'll have a connection.
Yeah.
If that connection exists, it can be strengthened or weakened. If it doesn't, no dice.
I see. And but if they weren't randomly connected,
mm-hmm.
if they were connected by some architecture,
would this change?
Yeah.
I guess you'd have to tell me what that architecture is, and then and can anybody reasonably tell me what exactly the adjacency matrix for a column in V1 should be?
No, I don't think so.
No, me neither. Yeah, right.
I have a question. At least from your plots, it looked a bit like your assemblies were completely non-overlapping. Was that the case? And if so,
no, it wasn't the case. Wasn't the case here. Let me move back a little bit. Ba-ba-ba-ba. Wasn't the case in the train system. I was kind of interpolating between two papers here. Where did they go? No, I must have passed it here. Where is it? It's when I do the inhibitory plasticity. After the movie. Okay. There. Okay. Let me see. It's this one here. Right. So here, I've ordered my neurons here in terms of membership of an assembly. So I've got 20 different stimuli and that are making 20 assemblies. If a neuron is a member of multiple assemblies, it gets double labeled here, right? So the way we set it up is each stimuli had a certain probability of driving a neuron, or a better way to say it is each neuron had a certain probability of receiving a stimulus, right? The way we set that probability up is a third of the network didn't receive any stimulus. A third of the network received one stimuli, and the other remaining third of the network received two or more stimuli. So there was a third of the network that were charged of being members of multiple assemblies. So there was overlap.
Did you try to sort of push the boundary of the capacity, say?
Yeah, like how many we could put in. We haven't done that yet. These assemblies, these simulations take a long time to run because we have to train the system up. So we haven't really pushed how many assemblies can we jam into this network.
Oh, okay.
So that's one. That's the capacity calculations for this would be really exciting to do. That's a good question. Yeah.
Thank you.
No problem. Oh, Tatiana.
Perhaps a related question, but what determines the number of assemblies? Is that
the stimulus paradigm? So we had 20 stimuli, and there was a probability of so with 20 stimuli, we chose 20 stimuli to train our system up with. We could.
But what about parameters of the inhibitory spike time independent plasticity rule? Without it, you don't get assemblies. So at some point, its parameters should determine.
How many assemblies? So I guess there's a difference. How many assemblies I want to embed may similar to this question. How many assemblies can I embed? Right. So we haven't done that. We've done. To be fair, this was 20. I know we can put 30 in. I haven't tried 100 yet. So you're right. So we haven't looked at the capacity calculation. I do know that the parameters of inhibition tell me how many assemblies can be simultaneously coactive at any moment in time. Right. That's certainly we could control that with inhibition. Yeah.
I was wondering whether you have thought about other predictions. I was wondering whether you have thought about other predictions that you could derive from the model that are experimentally testable that are maybe more unique because the quenching could be explained by other mechanisms as well, right?
So some more specific predictions. I guess looking at, so since my quenching mechanism, so one alternative mechanism for quenching is this is completely cellular, right? This is a cellular property that the quenching happens. So this quenching dynamic may not explain quenching of joint variability across groups of cells. So in my network, that's the case. So it's not just variance that drops, it's covariance as well. So if we look at the covariability of groups of cells, it is also quenched. Whereas mechanisms that are specific to the cell will capture the variance drop, but leave higher order statistics invariant. So that's one prediction. That's already been tested and we're right. So in that sense, I've already passed that prediction. But I'd like to know if that prediction is true in other cortices as well.
So it's related to your answer to Chuck's question.
Mm-hmm.
So in rodent V1,
mm-hmm.
the cells that are sister cells tend to have similar tuning without the experience.
Mm-hmm.
So would that be something that predisposed the network that
So if there was another mechanism that was promoting sort of non-strictly random structure between cells, so before eye opening perhaps, before training could even happen, cells that have sort of similar tuning
or direction,
right?